couple of quick announcements. Next Sunday, we will have baptism Sunday, and for the two of you who are here, we'll be meeting for class again during part two. The following Sunday, I hope, I need to confirm with him yet, I'm struggling to get a hold of him, that we will have somebody from Pi, from Alabama, preaching that Sunday as well, and Keith, the bishop, will be preaching next Sunday. And then the following Sunday is communion. I will be here preaching for that one, but that's our following Sunday. So we have couple extra weeks coming up here, or extraordinary weeks coming up. I also have to decide. So today we get to the big turn. So for those of you who have been waiting, this is when finally Jacob makes that turn. I'm going to try to post because it didn't get big. Mel sent me an awful video that was way too quick, so I will post it for you for your enjoyment. That really is not me, even though you might think it's me when you see the video. I did not have my foot out like that. That's the one difference in that video that you're about to see. So, yes, I'll probably try to post that to our Facebook page today if I can figure out how to do that. If not, I'm going to call my mother because she is the expert on Facebook, so... It's hard for me to believe. I would have never guessed my mother would become the expert. But, man, she can post things like nobody's business. Of course, I think the average Facebook user today is my mother's age, which is 83. So there's no young people there for sure, which she does complain about. Where's my nieces and nephews, and why aren't they posting anymore on Facebook, which is what she got Facebook for. Okay, so today we finally get to that big turn. Where Jacob is finally going to make his turn, and he is going to really make us put the stake in the ground and say that he is on fire for the Lord. Before we get there, though, we have one of the worst chapters in the Bible. I debated about skipping it. One of the people that I read and for commentary and for their interpretation of the Bible said this. This passage should only be taught to men in a males-only Bible study and has no redeemable purpose to ever be used in church. Yeah, so here we go. So with that terrible introduction, let's start with the chapter before the turn. I will say this, this chapter does not contain one mention of God in it. Now, Esther doesn't, it's a whole book that doesn't contain any reference to God, but this chapter, so if you look at the chapter just before, the verse just before it in verse 33, or chapter 33, we find that Jacob arrives in Shechem. Now, he should have went on to Bethel, but he didn't go on to Bethel for some reason. He decided to stay in Shechem, and the other thing I want to say, his children in this story, if you look at when Joseph got sold into slavery and when you try to figure out how old his children would have been and where they were when they left to come back to the promised land, it appears that his children in this story are late teens, and at the oldest they'd be in their early 20s. So they're probably someplace between 15, well, Joseph would have been younger than that. He would have probably been as young as 7 during this story. But his oldest children, Reuben, and the rest of them would have been pushing 20, 22 at the latest. So let's jump into this horrible story. And again, I'm going to agree, it is one of the worst chapters in the Bible. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, who had bore to Jacob, went out to visit the women in the land. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the ruler of the area, saw her, he took her and he raped her. His heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get this girl as my wife." When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the field with their livestock. So he did nothing about it until they came home. When Shechem's father Hamor went to talk, then Shechem's father Hamor went to talk to Jacob. Meanwhile, Jacob's sons came in from the fields. As soon as they had heard what happened, they were shocked and furious, because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not have been done. But Hamor said to them, "My son Shechem has his heart on your daughter. Please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us. Give us your daughters. Take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it." Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, "Let us find favor in your eyes, and I will give you whatever you ask. Make the price for the bride, the gift I am to bring, as great as you would like. I will pay whatever you ask. Only give me this young woman as my wife." This is the one story we get in the Bible about Dinah. Dinah, we knew that she was born. We get her in this story, and we get her no other time. We don't know what happened to her after this story. We don't know what happened to her before this story, but this is the one story. In many ways, she is a nameless victim, but she does get named because we know who she is. Now, there's a lot of debate about this, but we'll jump into it. We start out by saying that Dinah, again, remember the age that most people peg Dinah to be at is probably around 17 or 18. She's a very young woman. She goes out to visit the women of Shechem. A lot of people come down on Jacob and Leah saying, where were her parents and why did they let this young lady go around in the land? Because there are many stories that said that in this land, at this time in Canaan, any young accompanied woman was free for the taking. I don't know. I didn't live there, so I don't know if that's true, but that's what a number of people say. And so a lot of people come down to Jacob and Leah and say, why didn't you protect your daughter? What we do know is that she was out visiting the women of the land, and Shechem saw her. He was the prince. He was the leader's son, and he decided that he really wanted her, and he did things backwards, you all. He raped her. And then it says what? Verse 3. His heart was drawn towards her, and he loved the woman, and he spoke tenderly to her. It appears from the story that Shechem raped her when he first met her and then talked tenderly to her and wooed her into his house or forced her into his house. We don't know that, but what we know is throughout this story, she was living with him. Because as you're going to find out a little bit later on, the brothers know this, the dad knows this, and they actually then eventually get her back. But it takes them a while. I often wonder what happened between these two where he could get away with raping her and then wooing her or is forcing her to live with him. Either way, it's an awful story. It's an awful event that took place. Now, the thing that's also amazing is that no one in the land of Shechem, and again, I'm assuming Shechem was named after this man, but I don't know that either. No one seems to be troubled by the tremendous sexual assault and the tremendous sexual trauma that Dinah went through, or that it was even morally wrong. It appears that these two men, Shechem and his father, continued to be revered. And again, they're men of power, right? Shechem, by this time, is deeply in love with Dinah, and he goes to his father and he says, "I want this woman to be my wife," the man that he raped. Verse 5 is particularly sad. When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, it adds this little comment. These are teenagers and early 20-year-old sons. His sons were in the field with his livestock, so he did nothing until they came home. I don't know why Jacob was so passive. Was it, again, if this would have been the Middle Ages or the Middle East became what we call an honor culture, which is where if you are a male in a family and sister or daughter is sexually active or sexually raped, it is your job to honor her by doing an honor killing or by finding revenge. And so I don't know if Jacob just said, I'm going to do nothing because it's on my sons to protect their sister and to protect her honor and to seek revenge. I don't know, but we know he said nothing. Jacob's response to this great evil was silence. That was not the response of her brothers. By the time Shechem and his father arrived to ask Jacob for Dinah's hand in marriage, her brothers are home. Verse 7. Meanwhile, Jacob's sons had come in from the fields. As soon as they had heard what happened, they were what? Shocked and furious. Because Shechem had done, why were they shocked and furious? Because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter, the line that I really like, a thing that should not have been done. As we're going to find out, these boys took their shock and rage and did something very violent. You all, we all tend to react to things of shock and horror in one of two ways, to become silent or to become violent. It's the same in marriage. Think about the fights you have with your spouse. One of you is probably the more silent type and just goes off into the corner and thinks, and the other becomes violent, we'll put that in quotes, and just pursues the other person yapping like a little dog. And just talking and talking and talking. And the other person is in their little space trying to get away. And then the one person says, you don't love me because you're in the cave. And the other person says, you don't love me because you're yapping. And then it has a bigger fight. But even in marriage, you see the silence and violence options. When you hear the story, which one makes the most sense to you? Which one do you resonate with? Which one would you be? The silent Jacob or the violent sons? Now, you all, I would say that God prefers a middle road, but it's hard to see that middle road yet. So, Shechem and his father say, hey, name the price. You all, they have lots of money. They have lots of power. They can get whatever they want to pay for Dinah, to give Jacob the great gift. And then he says, what? Shechem's father says this, intermarry with us, give us your daughters, and take your daughters for yourself. You can settle among us, and the land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it. This is the first threat. So God calls the children of Israel out and says, be ye separate from the rest of the world, just like he calls the church to be separate, to be a part of the world but not in, to be in the world but not part of the world. He calls Israel to be the same. And so he said, come out among them and be separate. And this is the first temptation to give up that separation and merge with the people around them. That's what Shechem and his father are saying. They're saying, hey, let's become one. Now, they also knew that Jacob is very rich, so I don't know if they were just looking for his sheep and his animals and all that. But the temptation here for Jacob is to just become a part of Canaan. Don't stay separate. Here's your chance to be accepted by those around you, to become just like them. So Dinah's brothers hear the request, name your price. Whatever you want, we'll give you. They're still thinking, you raped our sister, right? I will say this. Jacob's sons have been deeply trained by their father. Of course, they saw their father in action. They know how to be deceptive. Lately, they just watched their father, tell his brother, hey, I'm going to follow you. And he went south and Jacob went north. They're all in deception. What I find interesting about this deception we're about to witness is they took what's going to become the mark of the Jews at this time, circumcision, tell you, the Bible talks way too much about circumcision. I'm just going to say. Oh, this is one of the most painful circumcision stories we're going to read. They take what is marked as sacred and holy, and the mark that what? Sets apart the Jews at this time, although those other people circumcise their young boys as well. But they take it and they use it in a defiling act that they're about to commit. Verse 13. Because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. They said to them, we can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who is not circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us. So they're saying, come on, we are Jews. They didn't say that then. We are children of Israel, which they are. But here's our mark. We must be circumcised. Our men must be circumcised. So therefore they say to him, this would be a disgrace if our sister was married to a man who's not circumcised. We will enter into an agreement with you on one condition only. You become like us by circumcising all of your males. Then we will give our daughter and then we will give our daughters and take of your daughters for ourselves. We will settle among you and become one people with you. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we will take our sister and go. Again, she's living with him. Their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. The young man who was the most honored of all of his father's family lost no time in doing what they said, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gates of the city to speak to the men of the city. These men are friendly towards us, they said. Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. Our men will agree to live with us. Under only one condition, that our males be circumcised like they themselves are. Listen to this, you all. This is the big pusher. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their other animals become ours? So let's agree to their terms, and they will settle among us. 3 days later, all the men went out to the city gates, agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised. What a painful day. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, I bet they were, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword. They took Dinah from where, you all? Shechem's house, and left. It's amazing to me that they left their sister at Shechem's house all the way till now. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies. These are the other sons, not Simeon and Levi. Came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks, herds, donkeys, and everything else in their city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth, all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, what did he say to them? You brought trouble on me by making me obnoxious to the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the people living in the land. We are few in number. They will join forces against us, attacking us. I and my household will be destroyed. But they replied to their father, should he treat our sister like a prostitute? Can't you see why this passage should only be taught? I'm not even sure it should be taught to men, probably. But man, what is redeeming about this story? But I will say, it speaks to victims, it speaks to what our response should be, and it speaks to how we respond. So the two brothers that responded, Simeon and Levi, are also Leah's sons. This is their full sister. They get these guys circumcised. I try to figure out, okay, rape and circumcision, is that a coincidence? I don't know. They get these guys circumcised on their third day when their pain is the most intense and they're most unlikely to walk or defend themselves. They go in and they kill every one of them, every male in the city. The rest of the sons come in, probably their servants, and they take everything out of the city. I mean everything out of the city. Including their women and children, which they probably took and sold as slaves and sent them away. They became much more wealthy. They became much more powerful as a result of this. When Jacob heard what his boys had done, he says to his two boys, what? You have made trouble for me. What a lecture that would have been. This is, you broke something. This is, you've destroyed me. You've made me what? You made me obnoxious to the people of the land. They are going to destroy us because you destroyed Shechem. Their response was what to Jacob? Wait. You're not going to defend the honor of our sister? You're going to let him treat her like a prostitute? We will not let that be. Levi is where the priests come from. This is the same Levi that became the tribe of priests. Once again, in case we needed another reminder, we see that God uses really awful people to do very holy things. Now, isn't it true that when we hear of evil things in and outside of the church, that sometimes we don't say anything when we should, and other times we become obnoxious to the people around us, and we rant and rave, and we do things that we shouldn't do. I would argue that today we face the same dilemma, whether it be sex or whether it be some other things that we should be speaking out against, and we either are silent or we become obnoxious and we become violent and take plunder where we shouldn't take plunder. There's a growing list of things that the church sees as wrong and sinful because of what God said that the world around us does not, and we have to decide, do we just say nothing? Which I would argue that too many times we say nothing when evil things happen within the church, and sometimes even outside of the church. But we also sometimes become obnoxious to those around us by doing violent things that we should not be doing, by saying and having the attitudes of things that we should not be having. We face the same pressure. What do when evil things happen to those around us? Both again within and without the church. Again, I hope that we find ourselves where in this land in Canaan, no one seems to be wondering about the morality of what Shechem did. I hope we think about we have a different set of morality. But then the message, the struggle that we have is, how do we communicate that to those around us? Now, I mentioned that Levi became used by God, and he became the leader of the priest. However, I want to point out one thing about these two men. When Jacob goes to give them their blessing, when he's about to die, he gives the blessing to each of them, just like his father gave him the blessing that he stole from his brother. And when Jacob is going down through the list, he comes in chapter 49, he comes to Simeon and Levi, and he lumps them together. He's going through Leah's sons, and he says this, what? This probably should be on your screen. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Remember what they did? They took out their swords. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger. They have hamstrung oxes that they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. So when Jacob gets to bless these two men, he says what? You are cursed because you did violence senselessly. You used your swords in a senseless way to kill the men of Shechem. You all. What's so amazing, we talked about this already, about Levi. Levi does not get land in the country of Israel. Because Levi, so one of the things that's amazing about this prophecy and this blessing that Jacob gives over Levi and Simeon is that they both do get scattered among the other tribes. One for good, Levi. And why did Levi get blessed? He got blessed because of the tribe's response to the golden calf. They were one of the few people when the golden calf happened that responded in a way that God was God-honoring, and God made them priests as a result, and they were scattered across Israel as a blessing. What happened to the tribe of Simeon? The tribe of Simeon became so evil and so outside of the will of God that God took the tribe of Simeon and they got scattered and they ended up in the country of Judah, but there was no more tribe of Simeon. It was scattered because of their evilness. This prophecy comes true for both of these tribes. They are scattered in Jacob and they're dispersed across Israel, one for good and one for evil. The part that I love about that, they both did the same sin here, but one gets redeemed and the other doesn't. You still have choices you can make even after you've done something as evil as this. But God used Levi after this to be the priest. Again, not that we need another example of this, but God uses people like us who do bad things and things outside of his will for great purposes. What a mess. The mess inside of Jacob's family has become so strong that the smell is noticed by those people around them. They all smell it. Charles Spurgeon says this: at this point, Jacob has one thing he can do. He can either end his family and say, we're done, or he can mend it. This is the crisis point. We are obnoxious. We smell to the people around us. We are about to be destroyed. And Charles Spurgeon said, hey, Jacob, you have one choice. You can either get off the horse or you can mend your family. What does Jacob decide to do? Finally get out of this chapter. We get to 35. Chapter 35, we get to see God show up. Verse 1, then God says to Jacob, go up to Bethel. Bethel's the house of God. Bethel's where he should have been. Bethel's where he met God on his way out of town. Go up to Bethel and settle there. Build an altar there to God who appeared to you as you were fleeing from your brother Esau. So Jacob said to his household and all that were with them, get rid of the foreign gods that you have with you. Purify yourself. Change your clothes. Then come, let us go to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, who has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave Jacob all their foreign gods that they had and their rings in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the oak at Shechem. And then they set out, and the terror of God fell on the towns around them, so that no one pursued them. Jacob and all the people came to Luz, that is Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and he built an altar, which he called the place El Bethel, because it was there that God had revealed himself when he was fleeing from his brother. Weird little aside. Now Deborah, his mother, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oaks outside of Bethel. So it was called something. Which means the weeping of the oaks, or the weeping at the oaks. Jacob returned from Padan Aram, and the Lord God appeared to him again and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name." Oh, listen to this again. What does God do? The same thing he did before. "Your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel." So he named him Israel. God said to him, "I am the God Almighty, El Shaddai. Be fruitful, increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from you. Kings will be among your descendants. The land I give to Abraham and Isaac, I will give this land to your descendants after you." The Lord went up from him at this place where he had talked with him. Jacob set up a stone pillar and at the place where God had talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it. Jacob praised the place where God had talked with him as Bethel. Called the place Bethel. You all, we finally get there. We're finally here. God tells Jacob, "Hey, you're in the wrong place." As many commentators say, Dinah wouldn't have had to suffer the sexual assault that she suffered had her dad gone to the right place. God tells him, "Go to Bethel." Finally, Jacob says, "What am I going to do? I'm going to be serious. You all, let's get rid of all of our gods." How many foreign gods did his wives and children have by now? We don't know. But there were more than one. He also tells them, "Purify yourself and change your clothes." What do we know in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, when people changed their clothes, it was a what? A reference to clean up your character, change your heart, get a clean heart. And so this is symbolic of saying, "Hey, clean your heart. Get clean, come clean." Then they also gave in their earrings. I'm not going to make many statements about earrings. Don't think this means you can't wear any, but that's for another time, another debate, another lifetime. You all can have those debates. Why do we think that he had all the earrings taken from the women who were wearing them? Sign of ownership, yep. And oftentimes it was associated with what? Pagan gods. I think that's why he gave them up. It's always, by the way, for those of you who grew up Mennonite, this takes on a whole different meaning. When you can wear earrings and when you can't. But the thing that's always interesting is to listen to commentators struggle with this verse about should we wear earrings today and what does that mean and what does it mean if women wear earrings. I don't think it necessarily means you're worshiping idols. There's a lot of people that worship idols that don't have earrings, and there's a lot of people that have earrings that do worship idols, and there's a lot of people that wear earrings that don't worship idols. But anyways, earrings aside, what did Jacob do, you all? He took their clothes, he took their idols, he took their earrings, and he buried them on the oak tree outside of Shechem. Jacob is saying, "My people, we are leaving our past behind us and we're going on with a clean heart to worship God freely and clearly." It's a long time, but Jacob gets there years later. Years later. Think how long his wives and children and probably Jacob worship God and idols. It's a long time. He goes up and they go to Bethel and they build an altar. Wow, I can't speak. And they worship. God's response that he wanted was what? Not silence, but violence, but be in the right place and worship me. How does that play out in individual things that we see and struggle with in life? It's unclear always. But the place that we need to be is in fellowship with God, where we're worshiping God with a clear heart. Chapter 8, by the way, verse 8 just seems to be thrown in there out of the blue. He's worshiping, and then we get this note that says what? Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak outside of Bethel. So he named it the Oak of Weeping. We haven't heard about Rebekah since he left home. One of the things that's glaringly absent in the telling of the story in the Old Testament is what? Rebekah's death is never noted. Many people believe that's because she was what? Not viewed positively by God for what she did to her husband. This is as close as we get to any note about his mother's death, and it's not even his mother. It's his mother's nurse. We assume that Rebekah has died by now. We get to hear that she was buried with her husband later on in the book of Genesis, but we never get to know when she died. We know that Jacob never saw her, because we're going to find that out when we get to the end of this. Most writers say that the reason that he wept so hard with the passing of his mother's nurse was that was his last connection to his mother. Somehow it seems that when his mother died, his mother's nurse found it to his household, and she lived among them until her death here, death at this point. And when she dies, Jacob weeps violently, because that's what? His last connection to his beloved mother, who he never got to see again when he left. What I find fascinating about that is, just because you clean up your heart and you come before God with a clean heart doesn't mean you're not going to experience pain of grief. You still will. Right? Grief will be with us because it's what we experience as humans in the midst of loss. But it's also one more thing that Jacob has taken from him here, is that he turns to clean up his life, he also is cleaning up, hopefully, that deceptive part of who he was, that deception he shared with his mother. Then God appears and says to him, "Hey, Jacob, remember your name is Jacob, but I gave you a new name. Remember, your name is now Israel." And then he renews his promise with him again, where he says, "I'm going to make you a great people, and you're going to bless the entire world." Jacob then sets up a stone pillar where God talked to him. And this is the only time before the law was given, and we got to hear about the sacrifices, that we get to read that somebody did a drink offering or a pour offering to the Lord. And that's listed there. What a time for Jacob to turn his life around. Going back to Charles Spurgeon, "You either mend or give up." And he meant it. Verse 16. Then they moved on from Bethel. While they were still some distance from Ephraim, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. And as she was having great difficulty in childbirth, the midwife said to her, "Don't despair, for you have another son." As she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named him Ben-Oni, but his father named him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to whatever city that is, which is also known as what? Bethlehem. Where Jesus came from. Over her tomb, Jacob set up a pillar, and to this day, the pillar marks Rachel's tomb. Israel moved on again. We get to see he's by his new name. And pitched his tent beyond Magdala Elder, or whatever that is, while Israel was living in that region. I love this passage. Just drops these little bombs on you all the time. Bang, 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 bang. Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, who was what? His stepmother? I don't know what you would call him. His sister's mother? I don't know. No, it's a mess. And Israel heard of it. Boom. Jacob hears about it. And then just because we get to see all Jacob's sons. There they are. So Leah has Reuben, her firstborn, who we just heard about, went to sleep with what? His mother's servant. There they are, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Just met with a guy Friday night who just had his seventh child. And he told me we allowed our children to pick the child's name, and they picked Zebulun for their child's name, so that's their new son's name. He said, I hope it doesn't mean the same thing that it meant back then, that my wife, which my husband will now honor me because I had six sons. He doesn't have six, he has four now. But and then we get to see, he slept with Rachel's servant, not his mother's servant. And we get to see them, and then we see Leah's servant and her sons. Those are the tribes of Israel, except for, Reuben, the firstborn. Do you see how it's spelled out there? Reuben, the firstborn, which means he should get double portion. He doesn't get double portion. We all know that Joseph does. There is no tribe of Joseph, right? Because there's a tribe of Manasseh and a tribe of Ephraim. Who is the tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim? Who are Manasseh and Ephraim? They're Joseph's two sons. He got the double portion. He got two tribes. Why didn't Reuben get a tribe? We just read about it. Here's you all, these do not seem like blessings to me. I would have been scared to death when my father was dying and I had to put my hand under his thigh and he got to say what he wanted to say about me. Listen to what he says about Reuben, chapter Genesis 49. I realize I don't have this on a slide. He gets to Reuben. He starts off with Reuben. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my mighty, the first sign of my strength. Excellent in honoring, excellent in power. Turbulent as waters, you will no longer excel, for you went onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and you defiled it. The same words we hear about Dinah. Why did he lose the double blessing? Why did he lose his position as firstborn? Because he went in and slept with one of his father's wives. This family. If we can go back to the brothers. If you look at Leah's sons, we have Reuben who lost his position, we have Simeon who lost his position, we have Levi who lost his position, and then we have Judah. The Lion of Judah. I'm trying to decide if I really want to preach the Judah story as well, because Judah is a disaster too. He has an awful story that we could tell. I'm thinking, do I really want to tell that one? I mean, I guess I made it through this one, so maybe, but Judah's has his own problems, but that's where Jesus comes from, right? He's the Lion of Judah. Let's go back to Rachel. Rachel's giving birth to the final son that Jacob has. She dies during childbirth. She names him Ben-Oni, who we don't call him. His name that his mother gave him means what? The son of my sorrow. It is interesting. I will say that doing these sermons has taught me a lot as well. I've learned a ton. There are a lot of people who write that she died because of the curse that her husband put her under. I did not ever think about it being so widely believed, but it's out there a lot. The other thing that people point to is she died because she told her husband, give me children or I will die. I like to believe it was the first one because of the curse that her father or her husband put her under. Jacob or Israel does not say, I'm going to keep this boy's name, the son of my troubles, and he turns it into Benjamin, which is what? The son of my right hand. This is the son that of my most honored. Which again becomes prophetic because Benjamin becomes a very important tribe, a very important leader in his own right. He also is the special one. In the story of Joseph, Benjamin is like the new Joseph. It's Jacob's youngest. It's the one who was born while his wife died. The one thing that Rachel probably loved more than anything in the world was his wife, Rachel. And here she dies in birth, giving birth to his youngest son. He too set up a pillar where she died, as you can imagine he would. Verse 27. Jacob comes home to his father, Isaac. After all this time, Jacob makes it home, and who's alive? His dad. Wonder what that reunion was like. I would guess his dad had forgiven him for what he did to him all those years ago. Isaac lived 180 years and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. His son Esau and Jacob buried him. Once again, we see brothers coming together to bury a father who they long since parted over and had their struggles around. But here they come back together to unitedly bury a father. This marks the telling of the story of Jacob. At this point, after one chapter where we talk about Esau, the book of Genesis, for the rest of it, talks about the life of Joseph, who becomes the next patriarch in the line. It goes, what, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, or Israel, and then it goes to Joseph. The rest of it is the telling of Joseph and how he becomes. Joseph is a very different character than the three men we've studied so far. Many people point out that Joseph is one of the few people in the Old Testament who has very few negatives. If the only negative you can get about Joseph in the entire retelling of his life is what? When he went to his brothers and said, hey, I had a dream about you where you all bowed down. He did have that dream, but is that something you tell your brothers? If you want to poke them, it does, right? What is the moral of this telling? I will say this. The Bible does not blink when it looks at who humans are. It looks with cold, direct honesty. I wish it would blink a little bit more. I don't need to hear all these torrid tales that the Old Testament tells. But I think it's a reminder to us that even when we have done horrible things, there is redemption. But it's not because of what we do, but it's because of what God does. The other thing is, Jacob lived a long time divided in his heart about who he was and what he believed. It was a long time till he became clean again. And you all, I'm sure that he had to do that again where he had to clean his heart again. Isn't that true for us? And how do we respond to terrific, horrible things that happen to people? How do we respond that it's not silence or violence, but one that God wants us to do? That's hard as well. And how do we stay from getting mixed up and integrated into the world around us rather than being in the world but not a part of the world? Those are all things that we struggle with today. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for yet another reminder that you can redeem us despite who we are. Father, forgive us when we do horrible things. I just ask too right now that you be with all of those victims that are out there who have been taken advantage of, who have been abused, and who have been harmed. Father, be close to them. Help them to feel your presence even when it sometimes is difficult for them to trust you. Father, help them to do that. I just ask, too, as we're reminded of Jacob's grief, both with his mother and his beloved wife, walk with those that are grieving. Touch those. Help them as they continue to have those memories that are both so precious and so painful at the same time. Thank you so much again in your name. Amen.